might be a bit sick of hearing about coronavirus, but the impact of the epidemic could be more far-reaching than illness and quarantine and cruise ships. There's the impact on the Chinese political landscape, for instance. Is the epidemic and some of the mistakes and secrecy that have accompanied it harming Xi Jinping's authority and future as a leader? Might it lead to any broader changes? Now, pundits seem to be in two broad camps. Either there'll be more transparency and accountability, or more crackdowns and state control of information. All of that, of course, affects how China interacts with the world. And overriding it all, how would we know anyway? It's so hard to read. Richard McGregor is a writer and senior fellow at the Lowy Institute, and he's joining us now alongside Graham Smith, a fellow of the Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the ANU and the co-host with Louisa Lim of the Little Red podcast, which discussed this in its latest episode. Welcome to you both.
Hi there.
Hi, Geraldine.
Is it true, I'll just ask you both for your thoughts, that the system is just too opaque in China to be able to read competently from outside. So I would ask you, Richard, what are the key signs you look for to try to grasp the lay of the land and whether it is shifting?
Well, I guess in top-level politics, you want to look at a couple of things, and we can see some of them operating here. First, has the top leadership got control of the narrative? In other words, the story of who knew what and when and who reacted? And in this case, the answer is no. Early on, when China looked like it was getting on top of this, Xi Jinping reappeared. He hasn't been seen much in public. He had a reassuring event at a hospital wearing a mask and the like. And things, seemed to be on the improve. Since then, it's gone really haywire. After that, when cases were getting worse, and we've seen a jump in cases in the last few days and a jump in the way of reporting cases,
just the way they even sort of describe or designate them.
They've changed them about three times in the last week. And then Xi Jinping came out and said, well, actually, I didn't first mention this on January 20. I first talked about this at a Politburo on January 7, which of course was when the virus was being kept secret and was starting to spread and information about it was being suppressed. So it's just a whole series of odd things. I'll say finally, how do you know something's wrong? When you start to see some sort of obvious divisions at the top, in the sort of officially party-sanctioned press, the People's Daily, Xinhua and the like, once you see threads at the top starting to unravel slightly, I think that's the best sign of dissent at the top, and that everything follows from that.
Have you seen those yet?
Not really, except Xi Jinping is meant to be in charge of everything. In this case, it's very much a collective leadership. So he's spreading the blame around. I think that's significant.
I mean, here we've had this sort of summer of saying, where was Scott Morrison there on the front line? I mean, that's been the sort of, the motif of the debate here. And he's so vividly, Xi Jinping is so vividly not there. It's again just a reminder, this is a very different culture and we have to respect that and they do things differently. But that's been very vivid, I think, to Australians.
Yes, well, I think a virus is like a bushfire. Sooner or later you can't hide it, no matter what the political culture is.
And Michael, what are you looking for?
Oh, sorry, Graham, you meant?
Graham, pardon me. Excuse me, Graham.
You're too used to having Michael Wesley on, I think. look, it's very interesting because, one of our guests, Orville Schell, was sort of seeing this very much in dynastic cycles terms. And it's coming 12 years after, I guess, China's last big natural disaster caused shakeup, when they had earthquakes and hailstorms and all kind of things the last time they had the Year of the Rat. So this, the response then was very much to tighten up and to very much, clamp down on things. But to go to Rich's point, I think it's very interesting that they've suddenly fallen back on collective leadership, because back in 2008, when things were going haywire, Hu Jintao, the previous leader, was very much about delegation, not putting his face on stuff, you know, be it the Belt and Road, be it the anti-corruption campaign. He was very much a delegator. And for Xi Jinping to go from, you know, being in control of everything and projecting this aura of confidence, invulnerability, and the lack of hesitation. I mean, this was there right at the start of his political career. Budrutum, we don't hesitate. And suddenly they're dithering between, I'm in control, I'm delegating, I'm the people's leader, I'm just a guy who's, you know, managing things. So, yeah, there are a lot of parallels to our bushfire response in many ways.
Yes, but, I mean, it is interesting to consider whether the essential compact, as people have written, between the party and the Chinese people is that Xi is increasingly been dominating it, will provide competence as part of the trade-off for more crackdowns. He can't afford to appear incompetent, can he? Isn't that a crucial thing to watch for, Graham?
Look, absolutely. And that's the danger of Xi Jinping having put his face on so many things, you know, to really be the face of the regime rather than just sort of one grey man amongst nine other grey men. Now he's sort of very much out in front of everyone else. And it was telling that the first sort of senior leader to be sent to Wuhan was the premier, Li Keqiang,
yes,
who, you know, we all sort of refer to as the invisible man. And suddenly the invisible man was very much required to be there on the ground in Wuhan. And a lot of people have been joking, we'll know the situation is under control when Xi Jinping shows up in Wuhan. But the fact that he's not there and having sort of cultivated this sort of Mao-like aura of being in charge. And you can't imagine that, you know, facing a situation like this, Mao would have not gone to Wuhan and you know, stood there on the streets and done something theatrical. His reluctance to sort of leave Beijing and be seen physically on the front line, I think, is quite costly to his legitimacy.
Yes, and I mean, Richard, there's a small list growing, isn't there, of perceived incompetence. There's the COVID-19. There's the widespread pig virus that wiped out 3/4 of the country's pigs, an incredibly important culinary staple. And there's Hong Kong. And then there's Taiwan sort of coming into it again, but on the sidelines. You know, you can't imagine that's being missed by, because he's jailed a lot of his confreres at that elite level, but they've got sons and daughters who are surely there watching.
Yes, on the pork is interesting, by the way. China has a pork reserve, strategic pork reserve, and they just released more from it yesterday. So I think we want to distinguish. I distinguish between the elite and the broader populace.
Sure.
It's hard to generalise. I think the elite, many in the elite, many of the technocrats, many of the first families, they're already severe critics of Xi Jinping over many things, over his management of the economy, over taking on America, in other words, bringing on a fight with America, which China doesn't need, over perhaps a little bit over Taiwan and Hong Kong, their sort of problems on their own in some respects. I think the virus, COVID-19, is very different because that, I think many of, you know, Chinese people probably have a very positive view of Xi Jinping. The economy has still been growing. They like the anti-corruption campaign. But this is something different. This is something he can't control. This is something he can't pretend is not happening. And it's getting worse. You literally have hundreds of millions of people in lockdown. People can put up with that for a while. Chinese people are very stoic. They've been through a lot. But you can't put up with that forever. And most importantly, I think, is the economy. It's hard to know the impact on the economy. I think it's been underestimated so far. And if this has a sustained impact on people's living standards and it's related to the management of the coronavirus, then I think that could really eat into his legitimacy. It's too early, I should say. We shouldn't get too far ahead of ourselves.
No, but you think that, do you? You think it's...
Quite, you know, and we have to look forward to the next party Congress 2022, and that's when he comes up for re-appointment again, and that's when he said he's not going to have a successor follow him. And I think it starts to come together there, particularly if the economy falters.
Well, one assumes that there... I mean, they're hemmed in here. They've got to have reasonable statistics, haven't they? So one assumes that the next growth statistics must come down to something like a 2 or a 3% figure. And if they keep it up at 5 and 6, people will say, well, then we won't ever believe them. So that becomes, Graham, wouldn't you agree, that's a tricky figure, because the view has been that if they didn't deliver perceived economic growth, again, that would be a break in the compact of competence and that sense that that will always provide Chinese people with a rise in their own living standard.
Look, that's absolutely the compact. And in many ways, the state media is sort of already anticipating that that narrative. So they're talking about sort of a V-shaped dip, that there will be a dip, and we're acknowledging that there's a slowdown now, but the economy will bounce back in the wake of the virus. And when we talked to Stephen Roach from Standard & Poor's, he overall was of the opinion that that is what would happen once the virus, through its natural cycle, passed through Wuhan and passed through the rest of China, and eventually pass through the rest of the world. But the key variable that we really don't know about is debt and this extremely high level of leveraging in the Chinese economy. And it was sort of joked about in the Great Financial Crisis that you didn't know who was swimming with no pants on until the water got drained. And this sort of external stress on the economy is going to really, test how much of a problem debt is for the Chinese economy structurally, because you have a lot of people, particularly in private business, who aren't being paid for their work, who already couldn't access finance. And I think there'll be all kinds of pressures in many ways on the most productive sector of the Chinese economy simply to say, look, this is too hard. We're heading for the exits.
Yes, my guests are Richard McGregor and Graham Smith. Richard from the Lowy Institute, and Graham Smith from the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs at the ANU, and we're talking about how to read this rather opaque society. I noticed, like, there are a range of things I'd like to take up with you, but I noticed, for instance, even in terms of the way we discuss this, that probably our best investment person in Australia, Hamish Douglas, the Magellan Financial Chairman and Chief Investment Officer, has really warned in a big conference yesterday in Australia. He's warned all of us, I think, and the nation's parliamentarians in particular, are whipping up xenophobic sentiment about China and playing national security out as a political issue, undermining Australia's most important economic relationship. Can you see, Richard, I mean, do you think there are any risks in the way the world more generally, but Australia, is talking about this this epidemic?
I don't see any risks in the way Australians are talking about this epidemic. I mean, I guess the issue for China in bilateral relationship is how the government has handled it. And it's hard to be too critical of the government. Let's leave aside Christmas Island, which looks kind of like trolling in a way, but the...
Although they've all been quite happy coming off it.
Well, yeah? Eventually, yes, it's worked. But, you can quarantine people much closer to home, et cetera, but... Australia's done very well, actually. We've had very few extra cases. You look at Japan, you look at Indonesia, you look at Italy, Korea, South Korea, Italy, Iran now. It is spreading. I think the CDC in the States is on the verge of calling it a pandemic. Australia should be able to protect itself. We're an island nation, but we have done quite well. Now, the Chinese government has been critical of Australia, saying it's an overreaction, but that's the talking point you see all around the world. If you follow them on Twitter, they're saying it in just about every country. We've done it to our economic detriment. In other words, with the students, keeping students out. UK and Canada have made exemptions to them. But as far as keeping the virus under control so far, touch wood, Australia's done quite well, and frankly, that should be the priority of the Australian government ahead of immediate worries about bilateral relations.
Mm. Yes, I mean, it's just the tone, I suppose, and we'll come to that in a moment. The tone that is used, I suppose, as they face this gigantic crisis, maybe some of it, self-inflicted.
Well, no, we should show sympathy and empathy and the like.
I mean, but we like that about our bushfires.
People, yes, absolutely.
We made some mistakes too,
absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely, yeah. No, totally, we should show. I don't think the government has been critical of their handling of it. I think that's the main point. They look at what the people at the top say.
Mm. What is interesting, Graham, is what is emerging from some very interesting writing about public health in China. And I just wonder how you do read it, because this is from China Policy, an online journal that I get, in talking about in Beijing's policy ecosystem, public health has never actually had much traction. And their reading of it was that while they might be putting on a stoic face externally, this is the public health people, internally they were really panicking. And there was an extraordinary amount happening between under the surface because the systems weren't all that good. Now, can you see changes coming to China? And because, you know, now they've had SARS and the two big outbreaks of disease, if you leave aside Middle East respiratory syndrome, have all come from China, you know. So there's clearly something happening there that's not right.
Yeah, and it's a difficult thing. I mean, Xi Jinping, as chairman of everything, has a lot of priorities that he puts his face on, but public health up until now has not really been one of them. He's not sort of in charge of that leading small group. And it's fascinating when you look at some of the things coming out now that really will be getting the leadership a bit antsy. The biggest rise in cases and in many ways per capita, the sort of highest number of cases, are now in a rather congested part of Beijing in Xicheng, the sort of the center, the sort of western center of town, which will have them very antsy. And for a long time, hospitals and the public health system have been racked by corruption. Just to give a small anecdote, I looked at the buying and selling of positions, and when you compared it across places, the one position that always merited the biggest bribe to get the job was the head of the hospital.
Really?
So there's all this kind of dreadful corruption going on within hospitals, and it's notorious. People know, you know, people joke about going to the hospital and you know, basically it's a sort of ticket to sort of poverty and getting sick because there's corruption on the medical side where, you know, people in the pharmacy industry expect kickbacks. There's all kinds of under-the-table payments that are expected. And so in some ways, you know, the public health system in China is really struggling through lack of resources, and it's doing the natural thing. It's trying to find other ways to keep the hospitals open, and it's often not very pretty. So I think the response, as you expect from this regime, is going to be to go for more control. And that, you know, is probably bad news for corrupt hospital officials. But that's the only likely response I can see rather than greater transparency.
You got any thoughts on that, Richard?
Well, the hospital system and the medical system is complicated in China, like in most countries. But remember, when the state industries collapsed, then medical care collapsed along with it. They've been trying to rebuild it ever since then. They don't fund them properly. You know, about 70 to 80% of recurrent funding, ordinary funding for hospitals in China, is from drug sales. You know, people don't go to the doctor; they go to the hospital where they're prescribed, you know, pharmaceutical drugs, and you know that means for overprescription, as Graham says. Services are limited. You often have to, you know, pay a bribe somebody to get proper treatment. Doctors are under great stress because, you know, there's been a huge number of cases in China recently where doctors have been attacked by the families of patients for not getting care. So the health system is already under stress. It's struggling to keep up with the absolutely rapid change of pace in life in China generally. And to have this descend on it on top of that is really, really difficult to manage.
Well, that's very interesting. So presumably families, so that's a sort of a question of a whole system that hasn't really been set up, presumably because individual families were presumed to pay. This is this big migration, isn't it, an attitude of what we see in China, is
plus
whether they're going to make...
They're just developing an insurance system, you know, it's in its nascent stage.
Yes.
And there's no national medical insurance.
Okay, look, I want to...
And to be fair, that insurance system is you know, proving fairly effective, much more effective than we'd expected.
Okay, look, I just finally want to move to this other area that is also occurred this week. The three Washington Post journalists being expelled, because I suppose this is another byproduct, casualty of the virus. And it goes to how Chinese society and politics might be changing. Could you explain what happened there, please, Richard?
Well, it's a number of things. It's a bellwether of how bad bilateral relations are with the United States. It's Chinese anger about reporting on the coronavirus. It's Chinese retaliation for what happened in Washington this week, whereas where the US sort of mandated that Chinese state-run outlets were controlled by the government and then would thus have to register as foreign agents. And it's also in particular in retaliation to a Wall Street Journal editorial, which was headlined "China as the Sick Man of Asia," which has all sorts of echoes of sort of racist things said about China in the 18th and 19th century. But it's
when the Qing Empire was
collapsing. Whole bunch of things, but really it tells you that China's relations with the West are bad and getting worse.
And there's also, I think, a lot of sensitivity about New York Times reporting too, isn't it? Because I think it was that paper that actually named the difference between the January the 7th and the January the 20th date that you mentioned earlier, Richard?
Yeah, I think so. But the New York Times in particular has a fabulous reporter, an Australian called Chris Buckley, who went to the ANU, like Graham, I think. He's been in Wuhan from the start. He's very scrupulous, very fair. But he's been attacked by name by the Chinese state media this week. So I hope he doesn't suffer the same fate.
Graham, your thoughts about, I suppose, you know, one of the things that has come out in the Global Times was you did sense that they were, despite all of their rhetoric, deeply offended by that China, the real sick man of Asia, which has all those overtones back to the decline of the Qing dynasty and so on and so forth and the long aftermath of the Opium Wars. So do you sense that this is a genuine response or, you know, how offended are they?
Look, there's a lot of theatre involved, and it's telling that none of the three reporters who've been sent home from the Wall Street Journal had anything to do with the editorial. I think it's very much a case of you know, just shooting whoever's to hand. And, of course, one of them, Philip Wen, is an Australian. He's not even American. So in the case of poor old Chris Buckley and the sort of attacks being levelled at him by the Global Times and other outlets, describing him, among other things, as anti-human in his behaviour, a lot of them, I think, it's a chance for a square up, because Chris has reported, done some fantastic reporting, not just on this, but more, I think, more sensitively to the regime on Xinjiang, and particularly release of both a cache of documents, which he was involved with other news outlets, and a series of leaks that they managed to get from very high levels. That, I think, really had them offside. So, you know, I think they've had Chris's number, and for that matter, Josh Chin's number for some time. So, yeah, it's theatre, you know, orchestrated by the propaganda ministry. I don't know. You could necessarily say it reflects genuine sentiment.
Look, the annual two sessions political meeting, when the top lawmakers and political advisers get together, is due in March, but might be postponed because of the virus. There seem to be conflicting stories about that. Will that meeting, when it is held, be particularly important this year, would you say, Richard McGregor?
Absolutely, because all sorts of benchmarks, particularly on the economy, in other words, the target growth rate, most importantly, are all laid down in the so-called work report delivered at the annual session of the National People's Congress. We have all manner of press conferences where officials are allowed to talk about things more openly than at other times. So it's a big event. It's pretty clear, I think, that it's going to be delayed or truncated in some fashion. Certainly there's no delegation from Hubei province coming this year.
No.
So I certainly think, and that's it's a loss of face, I guess. I wouldn't overestimate that, but it puts the whole political calendar back in China for some time. So it's pretty important.
Mm. I mean, you actually wrote in a Financial Review column, there are shades of Richard Nixon and Watergate in this. what are you getting at?
No, that was just, you know, what did he know and when did he know it? But sadly, China doesn't hold royal commissions like Australia, so I'm not sure what we'll find out.
But you are, by and large, if I hear you correctly, Richard, you're just saying, settle down, everybody. This is don't imagine there's going to be some sort of big fall. We're going to have to sort of interrupt all broadcasting.
Well, I could be wrong. I'm resisting people calling it this China's Chernobyl. It's just too early for that.
And Graham, what do you think about this big meeting, first of all?
Look, the big meeting's always tremendously important and, you know, tremendous theatre. Another thing that often comes up at these meetings, of course, is it is a way, particularly in the lead-up to the two sessions, for disgruntled officials to let off a bit of steam and sort of say things on the sidelines. Now, whether that is entirely muzzled this year as a result of, you know, actual sensitivity about the regime's legitimacy will be interesting. But I'm very tempted, if I have time, to throw a question to Richard. It's been surprising to me that Japan is the one country that is still open to Chinese travellers.
So is Thailand, actually.
Historically.
So is Thailand.
We're out of time? Oh, damn. I would love to know why Japan is open.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Japan and Japanese Sino-Japanese relations are kind of blossoming at the moment. I suspect Japan might be about to put some limits in, given the spread of cases there. I don't know whether it's the Japanese tourism industry, which is so dependent on China, has done that. But I'm surprised as well, actually.
Hmm. All right. Well, look, we will watch. We just been trying to work out at what point to do this story, because clearly you can't help but wonder whether there's going to be some shifts at that very high level, given what is unfolding. But you've calmed us all down. Both of you, thank you very much indeed, Richard McGregor, and also Graham Smith, who's the co-host with Louisa Lim of the Little Red podcast. And I welcome your thoughts.